Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moor pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon, all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 108 with my guest, the incredible soul singer, Robert Finley. He's got a brand new album out called Sharecropper's Son, and you all need to go and listen to that right about now. Before we get going, I'd just like to thank some of the recent financial supporters of the show. We couldn't do it without you. So thanks to Dylan Chernoy, John Dawson. That's my dad. My dad kicked in this month. Thanks, Pop. Nick Zaromsky. Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody. And I would also like to mention that we're up for a podcast award this year And the podcast awards are listener-supported, listener-voted awards. And I would love if you would go and give us a vote. So if you head over to podcastawards.com, and near the top of the page, there's a blue box where you can register to vote. And then you sign in and vote. And there's a bunch of categories. And we are, of course, under the music category. So you can vote on any of those categories. And you'll find us right there in the music category. So go give us some love. Thank you. And I also wanted to point out that I usually feel pretty good about the quality of the audio, especially on my half of the recording, because I use a really good mic to capture the interviews, and or at least my part of them. And I just wanted to mention that there was a bit of a mishap this month. My recording rig crashed early on in the interview. So what you actually end up hearing on my side this month is the crappy Zoom audio from my little earbud microphone. And I guess it could have been worse. It's not that bad, but let's just chalk that one up to technical glitches and roll with it, shall we? Thank you. So, Robert Finley, his new album is called Sharecropper's Son. It's on Easy Eye Sound, and it's a really killer recording on a lot of levels. He recorded it here in Nashville at Dan Auerbach's Easy Eye Sound. The recording quality is killer, as are the players and just the general electricity that flies out of the speakers when you crank this album on. I love it. And I do want to mention, too, that there's a few things that we talk about during this interview that I feel need a bit of explanation right now, since we end up talking about them, but we don't really give you listeners much background on what it is we're talking about. So let me do that now briefly before we start. So the abbreviated Cole's Notes version that you need to know is that while Robert has been playing music on and off his whole life, his real debut album came out at the age of 62, just a few years ago. He grew up and spent most of his life in Louisiana, where he was sharecropping with his entire family when he was just a little kid, and basically spent his entire childhood working out in the fields in Louisiana. Then he joined the Army and at that point got involved in music, sort of booking and putting bands together for functions and singing with various gospel groups, all sort of affiliated with the Army. And after the Army, he returned to Louisiana and started working as a carpenter and kept singing, of course. And at some point, much later on, he contracted glaucoma and is now legally blind. So his carpentry career was suddenly over. And we talk about this and about how he used busking as a way to get in front of audiences, particularly one time at the King Biscuit Blues Festival, which I think is in Arkansas. And through that performance of busking that he talks about, he got hooked up with the Music Makers Foundation. That is not the Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast. It is the Music Makers Foundation, and they take older blues and soul musicians out on tour and give them work and support. It's a very cool organization. And so when you hear us talking about music makers, that's what we're talking about. He made his first real album in 2016. He'd done a little bit of recording before that, but 2016 is when his first debut actually came out, and then eventually hooked up with Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys, of course. And at first, he came into the studio through Dan because he was just supposed to sing on a soundtrack to a graphic novel audiobook called Murder Ballads that Dan Auerbach was producing. But they got through that so fast that they had all this extra studio time. And in that extra time, they made an entire record that came out as Going Platinum. And that was in 2017. And then in 2019, I guess he ended up on America's Got Talent and got pretty far. I don't know much about, or I don't know anything about that. I don't watch TV, but apparently that's a thing. And there's those contests and he was on it and he was on TV and a lot of people know him from that. In any case, that's what gets us to where we are now. And Dan Auerbach brought him up to Nashville again to make the new record, Sharecropper's Son, which is a kick-ass soul record. Touches on blues and Delta blues and soul in very, very cool ways. It's very autobiographical, and a lot of the stories and narrative of the songs on the album just came out more or less freestyle, with the musicians laying it down while Robert improvised the lyrics. So go have yourself a listen to the album and check him out at his website, which is robertfinleyofficial.com. And Finley is spelled F-I-N-L-E-Y. That's robertfinleyofficial.com. And you can get albums and merch and check out his tour dates coming up. So thanks to Robert for spending time with me to talk about all this stuff. And here we go. Enjoy my conversation with Robert Binley.
Really nice to meet you. Thanks for doing this, man.
Oh, no problem at all. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you bet. So I do this podcast. I talk to a bunch of people, most of whom, like a lot of them are around your age, actually, that have been, you know, around studios and making music for decades. And I know you've been playing for a long time, but your recording career just, you know, basically started 3, 4, 5 years ago. I was wondering if you could tell me just a little bit about that path for you, and whether that was something that was kind of accidental or whether it was something you've always had in the back of your mind. It seems to be really kind of coming together at such an odd time for you. I'm just wondering how that started.
Well, actually, the first recording was did in 2000. It was Red Top Studio and Red Top Recording. That was in California, San Francisco. But it was a small-time thing. It was just a guy just happened to come into the club I was performing at and said that he would like to record me. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, it was a financial thing. And he was like, well, I'm not going to charge you anything to record you. I just want to record you. So he recorded a record, and we call it Age Don't Mean a Thing. But we didn't have, I didn't have any kind of connections or any type of way of and even social media wasn't as popular as it is now. Right. And have any kind of way of getting it around. But I sold out the first time I had some made. I just had a couple hundred made. Was bringing them home just for friends and family.
Yeah.
And so I actually sold out before I left California, so I had some more made up and brought it home to me. To be honest, I was in no way anywhere close to where we are now. It was just a hobby thing. Right. I was out there on vacation. I did something and I came back. And we got some local radio play and stuff. And then when ain't nothing new happening, it died down. So. I was busy with my carpentry and
right.
and my house building, and so I didn't put the effort into it. I had flew out maybe to California to do a couple birthday parties and stuff, but basically they would just fly me out. I do the birthday party and stay a couple days and fly me back. So that was. You know, that was fun thing for me to do. And it wasn't about a business. I never thought that I'd be actually doing it for a living, you know.
That was like 2000. That was like 20 years ago. So were you out playing with a band or anything? Or was this just strictly like kind of a pickup band and you were just playing for fun and nothing?
Yeah, just playing, just going to clubs and sitting in with the band, you know. If average club, yeah, and especially in on the West Coast, if you go in and walk in a place with a guitar, somewhere where there's a live band, basically, you don't really have to say too much or nothing. Somebody gonna ask you. All you gotta do is answer questions. Because first thing, somebody's, you know, there's always somebody that knows somebody.
Yeah.
And so that's how I wind up saying, well, actually, you just back and play anywhere you went. But actually, that's how it started in Helena, Arkansas.
Right.
The first, I went out there with a friend of mine, Tom Hardy, that owned the restaurants in Monroe that I performed at frequently. And the season had closed down for crawfish, so we wasn't he had shut that part of the business down. But he was catering at the King Business Festival. So he was like, I'm going out there. Won't you just ride out with us and, sell you my, because see, actually with him, he would keep me enough, little gigs from one restaurant to the other to pay the bills. Cause that was when I first, was diagnosed with the glaucoma.
The glaucoma, right.
And, yeah. And, I was making my living basically just hanging out. Well, really, he was just taking care of me because I could go out and I could tell him what a bill is, and he'll tell me where, you know, to come play at, and he'd take care of. So okay. It was just one of those things to where I was out there with him. His daughter overheard some guys talking about a jam session.
Perfect.
And so that's how it really happened. And she told me about it.
So was this the festival in like 2015 around then, or is this?
Yeah, right. That was the first. Uh-huh.
Okay.
And I went out there and I said, I got to do some investigating. And everybody was saying, well, you got to be on the list. You got to be have a busting permit, and you got it. It was a whole bunch of red tape. You couldn't just get out and play on the streets. You had to have a permit.
Wow.
To play. And so you had to go through the proper channel. They had to know that you was going to be there and that you was going to be busting. And,
okay.
And it had to be on the schedule so that the tourists would know exactly where everybody was at. So my chances of busting was slim to none, as they was telling me. See, they're not going to let you play, but we can have some fun. But I'm pretty persuasive. I knew if I got in touch with the right person, I would get to do what I wanted to do. When I finally found out about the jam session, they said, well, can't nobody. One guy told me, he said, this guy is the head of this. He running all this stuff on the main stage. Mm-hmm. He said, now, the jam session going to be on the main stage. Say, if you could talk to that guy over there, he said, whatever he say, that's what goes.
Okay.
So I finally got pointed in the right direction after a whole day of walking around asking questions and getting rejected. But this guy, I said, hey, man, how you doing? He was sitting up on stage by himself and making notes. And I walked up to him and I said, hey, man, I know you don't know me and I don't know you, but I sure like to rock this crowd. And he was like, what do you mean rock the crowd? I said, man, I like to jam on this stage. He said, what do you do? I said, well, I play guitar and sing. He said, you got a band? I said, no. He said, well, who? I said, this is a chance of a lifetime. I said, I'll make it or break it. And he said, well, he said, man, he said, you know, it takes a lot of courage for a man to come up. And he said, I really don't know nothing about you. He said, but if you come back, when you hear the music stop, we're going to be through rehearsing. He said, if you come back, he said, I'll let you jam or I'll give you the stage for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'll let you sing a song on it. And I went on back to doing what I was doing. And I left my equipment up on the stage because I was determined to rock that crowd. But it was
You're
funny
set,
because
set on that.
Yeah, I got. But when I got to playing the blues, it wasn't anybody there. It was no audience. It was just a sound check.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started playing, people started coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just playing the blues, and people started coming. So when I got enough people there, I sung song while I sang the blues. You know, I had wrote a version of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the people just started coming from everywhere. And so the guy, I finished the song and I looked around at the stage manager and he tells me, play another one.
Waiting to see if he's going to kick you off or not.
Yeah. And so he tells me, play another one. I played another song. I kept playing. And after a while he said, he said, man, he said, they're coming out the woodworks. And for, you know, and I can't see that good. So when I did pay attention to the audience, it was when I heard the applause at the end of the second song.
Okay.
And then I heard all that loud applause. So then, so
up to then you didn't even know if anyone was out there even or anything?
I really, you know, I was just watching my fingers.
Yeah.
And trying to make sure that I got it right because it's my, you know, I'm got to be the first and the last time. So I was concentrating. I didn't want no missed chords. I just watched my fingers. And I was singing with my head down.
Uh-huh.
So when I heard the applause, I raised my head up, and then people were there. So I had sung two songs, and the audience started to encore. And then I looked back at the stage manager because it's time for the show to start.
Yep.
And he said, sing one more. and so I went back and I did it by myself. So
there wasn't like a house band or anything. It was just you up there.
No, it was just me solo. Mm-hmm. And so then all of the musicians had gathered around in backstage by the time I finished the third song, and the audience was started saying more and more. And he said he asked me would I come back in a jam session. Mm-hmm. See, because I didn't know anybody, any of the musicians.
Oh, so this was literally just a sound check.
This was a sound check.
Okay.
That he just gave me the mic on and right. gave me, when he finished the sound check, he just told me, well, okay. He got up and told the people, look, this is Robert Finley. He gonna sing y'all a song. That's all he knew to say okay. about me. He didn't yep. say, he kept himself clear of it. And it was so funny. But then I knew if I just got a chance that I'm, yeah. on that big stage, I could capture the whole thing at one time. But what happened when I left the stage, the guys, the city had a store that they was doing stuff out of, mm-hmm. souvenirs and T-shirts and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So they offered me to sit up in front of their store.
Oh, okay.
And I sit up in front of the store and people start, and I play solo and people start coming there. So now I got the crowd is stopping before they get to the big stage. they would stop and check out, they had to pass right by me.
Yeah.
So everybody was stopping. And then I had a tip jug out and the wind was high. And when I really noticed it, people started picking up money, putting it back in the jug. Mm-hmm. That's when I realized my tip jug would have had overran.
It was full. Yeah. That's a good sign, right?
Yeah. And so I take a break and I go in the bathroom and I had me a backpack, that I had a backpack that was carrying my stuff in. So I just started putting my money in the backpack. Mm-hmm. And then I put my jacket back over on my back over the backpack. And I put the jug back out there and see if I can fill it up again. But, yeah, so it was fun. But then that's when I met the Tim Duffy guy.
And who's that?
And then the guy from Music Maker.
Oh, okay.
From Music Maker. He was the one that took the pictures, the first one that actually brought it to my attention about doing this thing worldwide. Mm-hmm. And he just asked me would I be interested in doing it. And I was like, yeah, but I didn't pay any attention because people are always talking crap and never yeah. follow up.
Sure.
So a couple of days later, well, maybe it might have been a week later than the following week, I did get a call from the Music Maker Foundation. And they wanted to come to Bernice and visit me. And I'm like, I'm skeptical. So I'll come to you. It's cheaper for me to come to you uh-huh. than it is for all y'all to come to me. So they asked me, he said, you'll come? I said, yeah, if you send a round trip ticket. I said, I'll fly out there. And then that way, if it ain't legit, I already got my ticket back home. I said, you got to send me a round trip ticket. So they sent me the round trip ticket mm-hmm. and picked me up at the airport. And when I got there and I saw all the people that, had been that they were supporting the musicians from New Orleans, when that yep. flood had come through. And I took it to be a real deal. First I thought it was just a gadget, and then I found out they were legit on what they were doing.
Where is it they were based? Like, where did you fly to meet them?
Let's see. It was
Are they in New York or something, or is it?
No. Carolina, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
That's what and
for people that don't know, this is an organization that essentially helps musicians that are in a certain...
Musician that's having a hard time when they lose all their equipment and stuff like that. And it was a foundation to help musicians get new equipment and try to put bands back together.
Yep.
Because a lot of people were just homeless and a lot of musicians were just homeless and out of work, you know, and then with no equipment to work with. So that's what... And that's, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, you know, about it. Not, you know, like I say, I couldn't read that good, but everybody that was reading it felt like it was a good thing, you know, they were doing.
Yeah.
And so I got aboard and got to, that was my first trip overseas I went with, you know, besides the military. Uh-huh. I went with the Music Maker Band and we played for schools doing certain events. They would, I don't know, something similar to, I guess, Black History we have here.
Yeah.
But it was school functions that I went to, and I was telling my story to different kids, and it was a whole about hold on to your dream, you know. Yeah. And I do that a lot in right here in Louisiana, too, because, you know, in Union Parish, where I live at, I play for the nursing homes. I play for the kindergarten. I play for the high school.
Cool.
You know, anywhere from 8 to 80, you know, they pretty much know.
They know Robert Finley.
Yeah.
So that organization set up a tour for you. So this was in Europe or?
Well, it was, we went to Europe and Spain and.
Wow.
I was in Amsterdam. We went few places. I went about three times that I went overseas with them.
Okay.
And like I say, it was a Music Maker Relief Foundation. It was a group of us that was all traveling together, but everybody in the band had their role, you know, to play. We were basically doing everybody just had so many minutes on stage. That was the guy Alabama Slim, you know, Lil Joe was from Chicago. He was a horn player. It was just musicians that had come together. We made a good team. Robert Lee. It was several guys. So many of them in there. You know that all had their own set. I mean, their own show each one could take the stage and we would always compete about who was going to get a house down, you know.
It was some friendly competition, never hurt anybody.
Yeah, friendly competition.
It sounds kind of like the old Stax reviews in the 60s or whatever.
These guys, the thing about these guys, see, I got aboard the thing, I got aboard at the age of 63. Mm-hmm. I'm 67 now, so I'm in there. A few years now. But these guys have been doing this stuff. You know, in my age of 63, I was the new kid on the
You were the new kid.
I was the youngest thing in the thing. So I had to, I had to pay attention to them and all of what they did and how they did because this was an opportunity. If they've been doing this for 30 years and 40 years, and you know what I'm saying? And I've just been doing it for 30 days, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
right.
I got to come in there like I'm supposed to be there. And but I always stood my ground as far as...
I bet you did.
I was determined, it's when one artist done rock the house and you hear all the screaming and stuff, it's hard for another artist to walk out right behind him and get that same reaction.
Totally.
So you either gotta get their attention
quickly
and you gotta keep it. Yeah, you gotta keep it because if you don't come out swinging, you know, if you ever let it just die down, they're not gonna... It's gonna be hell to get the house. So instead of competing against what they did, I would just add to it.
Yeah.
You know, in that way.
I like it.
Yeah. I would just continue what, like part two or what they were doing because I could play in any style. I knew I could harmonize within it with whatever the people wanted. So if they was in a jazz move, I could stay jazz with them, you know, and ease it out, ease my blues in. But it's hard to just, when people don't dance to, and then you just drop in and go to drop some low down blues on them. They are hype. They want to dance, and you know the blues. You have to know when to administer the blues, because blues will kill a party if you don't. But
those are things that come naturally to like a really seasoned performer. But you, at this point, are like, were you considering yourself a new performer, or had you been doing enough gigs over the last 30 years, or were you was it fresh to you?
No. It was just an opportunity to finish something I had started. Okay. See, when I was in the military, I was a program director and entertainer. So, and then when I got out of the military, I had my own radio show, Brother Finley and the Gospel Sister Gospel Hour. So I guess that's why I talk so much and don't get nobody else a chance to say nothing, because I was retired a radio announcer. But it was just for, you know, an hour on Sunday morning. Okay. But I did my own commercials. And
oh, so you had the gift for the gab going back then.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was always, I was, you know, we had a gospel quartet, which I was, I was a manager and the leader of that band. I had been doing gospel. I wanted to do things way back, but I had some young girls singing for me.
Yeah.
Backgrounding. And, I couldn't persuade their dad to let them sing the blues. He was kind of like my dad, you know, my kid's not singing no blues, because okay. their dad had gospel quartet too. And I played for them. That was the Harmony Five. After a while, we started another group, was the Young Gospel Brothers, and which, you know, we'll call, when kids see everybody in the family doing something, they want to do it. And as they got old enough to do it, we didn't deny them an opportunity to do it. We just organized them a group, because it was fun to me, because that's what I was doing in the military as a program director and entertainer, was to make sure that band members met each other, you know, just be a communication. So if you know a guy that plays horns and looking for work, you know, you put his name in your black book, and then somebody else looking for a guitarist, and before you know it, I got all of them information. And if I ever get them all to come together at one time,
you've got a band.
Yeah, I got a band. And in the military, that was no problem, because if you ever got a guy agree to come to band rehearsal, and if he's supposed to be there doing duty hours, and that's when you wanted to do it, during the duty hours, because it's not up to him once he agree to come. He got to report to duty. And if he's not there at time of a rehearsal start, he's AWOL. So it's a serious offense in the military to miss a band rehearsal.
Wow, that's a funny way to
look. Yeah, I mean, but but no one could just not show up.
Right. Okay.
You know,
so attendance was high.
Yeah. Everybody had to be there, you know, or they faced the consequences on Article 15. And back then, they wasn't cheap, you know. They could take half of your paycheck for you not showing up on time. So, but when I got out of the military, that's when, in the real, you know how you say, that's when things got different. And this is when I realized this really ain't what I want to do. These guys may show up, they may not. You know,
it's like there's no AWOL in real life.
In the real world, there's no penalty for not showing up. You can either fire the guy.
Yeah.
But you can't charge him, serious enough, you know, because all he's gonna say is, "I ain't gonna play if you're not gonna pay," you know.
Yeah. So,
but in the military, you had to be where you had to be on time.
Right. These gospel groups that you're talking about, like after the military, when you're playing in and managing these gospel bands, were they like just regional, playing around like in your church and in the area in Louisiana, or were you actually on the road with these guys, or what was that like?
Well, we set it in Louisiana, but we would, you know, go to Mississippi or you know, go to Texas occasionally.
Okay.
Because it always would be somebody in the family that lived in Texas or something that did the organizing for us driving out to do the show, and we'd be doing it at their church or something, you know.
Yeah.
But it wasn't one of the things like it is now, because it wasn't about the money. Everybody just loved what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
and getting a chance to do it for, you know, in front of so many people.
Right.
We used to go on a little local gospel show with Ernie Miles TV show, and it was called the Ernie Miles Show. We would go on there and perform, you know.
Oh, wow, cool.
And be seen locally.
So you were kind of known around the area as like one of the top gospel groups of that time.
Yeah, well, yeah, we had three groups in one. That was the whole thing. See, we had the parents, the older people were the Harmony Five,
mm-hmm.
and they had been singing, you know, 35, 40 years, you know, so they were well known. Then I organized the Gospel Sisters,
yep.
and then the Gospel Brothers, which was the Harmony Five's children. So it wasn't a whole, it was all family, just three generations. So the older ones would play, then the teenage girls would play, then the little boys would play. And at that time, the boys was ranging from 8 to 12, you know, they just wanted to be a part of it, and part of that stage. It's something about being out front, being appreciated, that people have hunger for, you know. That's doing it. If you're doing it for the wrong, out of ego trip or whatever, you don't get to enjoy that part of it.
That's right.
If you're doing it for the love of it, then what comes from the heart goes to the heart.
Yeah.
And people can actually feel what you're feeling. That's why I come up with the song "I Can Feel Your Pain."
Right.
That's on the upcoming album.
Because
it becomes a part of you giving your whole, you know, you put yourself into the character. Even if it's just like you would be making a movie, you got to be convincing.
That's right.
To the people that to make the movie be interesting. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what takes a great actor, and an actor. And some, you know, some people just read the line and call it word, but some people knows how to
work
convincing.
It.
Yeah, how to work.
Yeah, yeah,
it.
Yeah. With your new record, Sharecropper's Son, which is awesome. I love it. A lot of it feels very autobiographical to me. Could you maybe talk a bit about that particular song and just like how much of that is really like what your childhood was like? Because it paints a pretty, you know, harsh picture of growing up in that area and working really hard. And, you know, is that what your life was like as a youngster in that area?
Yeah. On that album of the Sharecropper's Son, there is no make believe. There's no role to play. That's true history.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why, I mean, it's no add to it. It's no taken from it. There may be some things that were unsaid, but everything that was said is real. I got 7 siblings, and I discussed that with them before I even, you know, decided to make that, you know, to
like
make
to
the
see,
album.
Like to see if they were okay with you talking about it in that way.
Yeah, I wanted, and then I wanted to to get their point of view because they're older than me. Mm-hmm. See, I'm the youngest son of the sibling, and I got one sister that's younger than me. She doesn't remember basically hardly nothing because she was so young at the time when we actually moved off the farm. I think I was 10 when we moved off the farm. Mm-hmm. So she may have been 6 or 7 years old. She don't remember because things she didn't, you know, she never had to do. If she was that old when we moved, but if you asked her, she'll just tell you she don't remember. But the rest of them, the other six, they know the story. Mm-hmm. And I told them at one point, it may be we have to write a book and everybody write their chapter.
Yeah.
As to how they remember it, because I'm telling it a bit of things that happened to me, things that I experienced. Mm-hmm. Quite natural, they experienced things that I didn't have to.
Sure.
Because I could walk with my dad and hold the plow, hold the line, and tell the mule what to do. I remember that. But it's a lot different than walking alongside your daddy and holding the line and telling the mule to yee and a haul or giddy up, whoop. Those things came natural. But our older brothers, they had to hold the plow too. So that's why I said, to me, I didn't realize it was even work. I'm at my age, I'm thinking it's fun. I cried to get out the house with mama to even go to the field with dad. Mm-hmm. So now I didn't realize that I was setting myself up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I remember riding on the sack. I remember my mom used to set me on her sack to keep me from wandering off in the field while she picked cotton.
The whole family, all the kids were out there like working in the field.
Yeah, my whole family was in the field. Yeah, you know? They like I say, all but my baby sister. Mm-hmm. She was in the field. She just don't know it.
She doesn't remember.
Yeah. Yeah. She was too little to stay at home by herself, so she was in the field. You know.
Yeah.
She might have been in the wagon or whatever. You know.
And, wow.
She was out there. If she cried, we weren't that far. You know, wouldn't be that far from. Well, we couldn't hear. But my mom basically took care of the house, but sometimes she would come out. If she came out, you know, the baby come too. And when we were little, see, we get over in the trailer and walk around and jump up and down. But we didn't realize we were packing the cotton. You know, that was part of the job too.
Yeah.
You know, you had to get it, pack the cotton, make sure you get enough in the trailer for the bale to weigh out. But that was something for everybody to do. So like I say, if you couldn't, you weren't big enough to pick, you could get over in the trailer and walk around and you started packing the cotton. And so when they come to empty the sacks, it'd be room for everybody to put more cotton in.
Yeah. But
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I remember my first sack was a flour sack. My dad put a string on the flour sack, put it around my shoulder, across my shoulder, and I thought I was doing something, you know, and I filled it up real quick. I got where I could fill it up real quick. Next thing I know, he done got me a longer sack.
Fill it up, fill that one up.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. You know, shit, before I know it, I got a damn 9-foot sack on my damn back. And I'm going to get a whooping if I don't fill it up today.
Could we talk a little bit about the new record? Like specifically, you know, the songwriting is, you know, we've talked a little bit about that and how personal it is for you. And I just wonder what the actual process of making the record was like. Maybe you could talk about your experiences with Dan Auerbach. And I don't even know where you made the record. Was it in Nashville or did you make it in Louisiana?
Yeah, it was in Nashville.
At Dan's place?
At Dan's place, yeah.
Oh, cool. So can you tell me a little bit about the sessions and how it actually went down? Because it's such a great sounding record too. Like it sounds very live.
Man, I'll tell you the truth. It happened so fast.
You don't even
know. You know, everybody was just excited to be back together. We basically had the same musicians that we had on the first album. Everybody was super glad just to be back together again, I guess, and get to jam.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the guys I had never met that played on the on a couple of songs on there, but most of the guys I already knew and from the last album. Mm-hmm. But when we did Country Boy, which is the soundtrack, you know, of the album, they were just jamming, warming up. The band was just warming up in the studio, making sure everybody's equipment was working and hearing everybody, and it's got the sounding good. I walked in the room, in the booth, and it was kind of rocking. And so Dan say, "Sing something with it." You know? and so I just started singing Country Boy.
So that's really how that happened.
It was not planned. It was not something we had sit down and worked on. It was just something just happened.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah, and
is that something you've done much of? Like, have you been in situations like at gigs and stuff where you improvise, where you just make songs up on the spot like that, or was that a new?
Oh, well, that's really the only way I ever wrote.
Really?
I used to want to be a poet, and I used to try to make things rhyme.
Yeah.
All through elementary school, you know, I would, and you know, I had to say things in a neat way at school, but I could make up a you know, riddles and stuff, just because the only thing was making the last word rhyme. And I don't know, it just came natural for me and I'd always have a crowd of kids standing around laughing, and we'd have contests to see who could get the most laughs and stuff.
Yeah.
But I always won, because even in the night clubs, when I got old enough to go into them, like, you know, I could just walk in a nightclub and for some reason I could convince the DJ to give me the mic, and everybody knew. I used to stand outside the club and people wouldn't go in. So the man would tell me, "Well, look, you need to come in so my customers would come in."
Man, that sounds a lot like freestyle, like hip hop.
Yeah, that's
the same
what
thing,
it was all
man.
About. Yeah,
wow,
that's
so
what
cool.
It was all about, just freestyle. Uh-huh. So when they started playing music, it just come, you know, it takes me back to you know, my younger days when that's what I used to do. Because me and a friend of mine, he's deceased now, but he knew exactly what music to play as a DJ, but he didn't like to talk. He didn't know what to say to the people. So
right,
we would call ourselves the Together Brothers.
And, that's awesome.
And, we would dress, you know, pretty much the same color. He would play the music.
Yeah.
I would pump the crowd. I was just, you know, because I could always think of something to say in between him changing. Now, back then, you know, you either had to have two turntables or you had to change the record.
Really
and,
fast.
Yeah, you had to be fast at it. And so I would keep the people attention until he get the next record on. Then once I hear the first beat of it, I didn't even have to know what it was because, you know, once I heard the first beat, I just start bringing it in, you know.
So is it just you with a mic up there, or would you have a guitar while you're doing that?
It'll be just me and the mic.
Wow, cool.
Occasionally, you know, sometime I would, we got where I would take a guitar and just sit in and do a song or set every now and then. But when I left home, I went back to Texas for a while, and there they was having gong shows and talent shows at the time. And most clubs was having them open mic nights. And so I started playing around them. The fact that I had made up my own songs and I was singing stuff nobody never heard before, you know, and the people liked it. So it was a chance to, you know, to get out there. It was a whole lot of promises, but never nobody really did anything. Like I say, until I got with the Music Maker guy, from Tim Duffy, and then went from there to Bruce at the Fat Possum Records.
Okay.
And then I found out later that Dan used to be on the Fat Possum label. And so Bruce and Dan had gotten together, I guess, and communicate. And Bruce had recommended that they try me for the voice on a book called The Murder Banner.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And that was all I supposed to been doing was singing those four songs.
Okay.
So I had to learn them and sing them. So yeah. Dan had a speaker in my ear to tell me what the next line was or the next verse was about.
Oh, really?
And I would just, because I couldn't read it, you know, and I would just sit there and I would listen to it. And I would listen to it while the band was playing. I would be listening to my part, trying to memorize word for word the song. Uh-huh. So we come up with this plan where Dan would tell me in my ear, and
that's cool.
And I would just holler it out, you know, boom. And then they was going on. They were laughing and going on in the control room, like, what the hell is going on? But they, you know, they was all just you know, they was lit up in there, and I'm like, I didn't know if I was getting it right or I was messing up that bad.
Yeah.
So, but we actually had 4 days to do the song. And we did all four songs. I guess we're supposed to be doing a song a day. I don't know. But we did all four songs in about 4 hours, five hours.
So you got 3 days left of studio time.
3 days left of studio time. And then, like, I don't believe this fucking guy. He walks in off the fucking street.
Was that the first time you'd ever met him?
That was the first time I'd ever met any of them.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't know nobody in the studio. And he was like, man, I don't believe this. And so all the guys were like, man, you hit it. You nailed it. He's a good singer, Robert. Good singer.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. I mean, to me, it was just, you know, just natural. I never thought anything about it until they started playing it back. And, you know, when I went in for the playback, and it sounded good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was singing along with it. And sometime I would background for my, you know, along with it. Mm-hmm. And so Dan picked up on that. And so he wanted me to do some of the my own background, you know.
Harmonies and stuff.
Yeah, whatever key he asked me to hit, I just hit it, you know. And I said, can you do the whole song there? And I was like, boom. So when we did Holy Wine, we had did their album. Holy Wine is on the Going Platinum album.
Yeah,
We had completed the album, finished the song, everything. And then we was listening at it. And I walked in the booth and I just started singing it in falsetto along with it, you know. And then Dan turned around and said, man, can you do the whole song in that? And I was like, I said, I don't know. I ain't never tried that, man. And
yeah.
I said, so we put the music back on and took the vocal out. And he says, let's see how it sound in falsetto. That became one of the.
Yeah, that's a killer song.
I was like, and I was just, you know, I was just playing.
That was a fluke.
I said, well, you know how it is when you know you done did your job and you completed. Uh-huh. Then I felt pretty good about it because Dan said he was satisfied with the cut.
Oh, so that the Going Platinum album was done in those sessions that you were just supposed to do the four songs in.
Right.
Awesome.
Because we had three days of studio time.
Yeah.
Already booked.
And, oh, man.
And so they was like, what to do with it? And so
yeah.
Dan asked me, would I mind doing be interested in doing an album? And I said, yeah. So he had the songs written on the Going Platinum album. And he's pulled them out. And
What do you mean? Like, he had the songs written for himself to make his own record? Or was he writing songs for you specifically?
It was him and Pat Goin and Bobby Woods. You know, they all, the Memphis boys, they all were working together.
Okay.
As songwriters, when there's no band in the studio,
yeah.
Then they write.
Yes.
Write songs for anybody who wanna sing.
Sure.
can sing them. So they had these written and I sung them and the guys liked it. And so they actually came out of retirement because all of them was just working in the studio. They wasn't doing any touring. They had all retired from touring.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, Dan wasn't doing any touring itself. But we was having so much fun in the studio. They came up with this plan, let's go out on the road one more time. Which was great for me because I got a chance to be on the road with some of the greatest musicians, you know, and the most well-known musicians in the world.
So who were some of the guys in that touring band?
That was Bobby Woods. Pat Goin, the guys that wrote the songs.
Yeah.
You know, me and Dan was the youngest ones in the group. you know, yep. And I was twice Dan's age. So yeah, it was like, you know.
But on the new record, you've got way more of a hand in writing the material then.
So in the new record, the songs are about my life. So basically, the guys just let me tell my story my way because it would have to be because Dan hadn't experienced what I'm writing about. And you know what I'm saying? The older guys, Bobby and them knew about it.
Yep.
But they wasn't that experienced. He knew about it because his dad owned the farm, a farm. So he knew about the sharecropping and he knew about all of this stuff. So when we started writing, when I started, everybody just kind of let me told my version of it. They did all the arrangements.
Yeah,
for the music and then.
So you're coming up with all the lyrics, the stories. Are you coming into it with the melodies for the songs also? Or are you kind of presenting like, hey, I want to sing about this. Here's a few lines, and then they put a tune together, and was that how it worked?
Well, we did it both ways.
Okay.
We sit down, and we talked and recorded, and then we wrote. The recording was basically just to a reminder of what you said,
mm-hmm.
because so we really were just recording and taking notes, just like pretty much like me and you talking.
Right.
It's basically what the writing was about.
That's great. That's a good way to do it, man. It really comes through, you know,
And then those guys, with them, hitting chords on the guitar that, you know, coming up with all these different arrangements that you haven't heard.
Right.
And that's the good part about it. It's every song has its own, you know, arrangement.
Yeah. For me, there's like a really interesting mix of like Delta blues and soul, like Memphis soul, and all those things are represented, but it's not like, it doesn't sound like you're trying to like recreate an Al Green record or anything like that. It's kind of got a mix of all those things, which is great, I think.
I always call it the gumbo.
Yeah.
You know, it's more or less a gumbo. It's got a little bit of everything in it.
Uh-huh.
And then, I do a demonstration like very few people would just walk up and pick a bell pepper and start eating it, you know. Some people, you know, people do eat raw onion. But very few people just going to walk around eating garlic.
Yeah.
But if you put a little bit of all of it
in
the pot together and boil it, you know, you'd be surprised. Because you got all of it in there. The combination is what makes makes it great. So these guys, and see, like with me, I'm blessed to where I can pretty much take my voice. I guess that's from growing up trying to imitate the preacher, trying to mark, sound like anybody that was somebody, trying to be an imitator. You could sound, I mean, I could sing just like Al Green. I probably could get away with it if people didn't see me. You know what I'm saying? I probably could do it to the, I used to try to imitate Ozzie Hayes, and I could go from here. And I even had songs where I would even imitate Sister Betty Wright's because I had that type of flexibility in my voice.
You got a range, yeah.
Yeah, falsetto seems like it's really hard, but it's really one of the simplest notes, you know, to sing in, because it's one of the less stress if you know how.
You have to know how to do it properly, though.
You just have to know how to do it. It's not like a lot. It seems like it would take a lot of screaming or a lot of pressure to do it, but it's a laid back thing to where you're really in control if you know what you're doing. And it's all about putting yourself in the right key to where you're comfortable.
Somebody that was, when you were a kid, that sort of gave you pointers and sort of helped you out with that stuff? Or was it all just like you figured it out by just doing it in church and stuff?
Oh, my dad would constantly, if I was, he sung all the time. And if I was singing along, I would try to sing along with him. And he'd always would stop and tell me what I didn't do right or where I was supposed to be, you know, stuff like that. He took the time to make sure that all of us could hold our note.
Yeah.
Because, like I say, the whole family sung in the choir, and we had quartet. All of my kids that want to, you know, they can. And I got one daughter that travels with me everywhere I go that sings back up. Background, but see, what people don't realize, it's going to come out and soon. Like, she's really not a backup singer, you know.
Right.
She's more or less a front and center singer. She needs to be out, you know, on the label, doing her own albums and stuff. You know, what I'm saying, which we probably wind up doing that before it's over with, but.
I'm sure.
Between her and my granddaughter, with this pandemic came up, it kind of canceled a lot of hope we had. But we were trying to work my granddaughter into the studio because Dan had heard a little piece of recording that she'd done, and he felt like she just needed an opportunity to get out there, too.
How old is your granddaughter?
I think she's 22, something like that.
And as far as the recording goes, like, was it all live off the floor pretty much with the whole band, or are the horns and stuff overdubbed, or like, how did you?
No. It was happening.
Okay.
Right then and right there.
Were the horn players like coming up with their arrangements on the spot, or was it all kind of like mapped out for them?
When we started that jamming, everybody was going freely what they felt.
Yep.
And just so, like I say, it was a It was a warm up. Supposed to have been the band was warming up, and everybody was just doing what they felt because it wasn't time to start. The recording hadn't started, and that's how it happened. You know, any thing you did, you know, it was no wrongdoing that you could do because we hadn't even, you know, made the.
It hadn't started yet.
Yeah, we hadn't started yet. Hadn't started recording, so everybody was just having fun. And I grabbed a mic and started talking about him, Country Boy, and I started telling my story. That's what it was.
There's two songs kind of along those lines on the record. There's Country Child and Country Boy. One's more of like a, almost like a hill country Mississippi thing, and then the other one's more of a blues. Are you playing guitar on those as well, or are you just singing?
No, I didn't play the guitar on it.
Okay,
whatever's on the track.
Yeah,
you know, I play by ear, so I play anything that I hear.
Yeah,
so quite natural on some of the trips. During the tour, and Dan won't be with me, you know, because he'll be, you know, back at the studio.
Yeah.
Then I have to know those tracks. So see, that's
right.
I have to be able to do it if I had to. If I don't, I can concentrate more on delivering the message because it's the guitar. I love it, but it's like having a horse in the stall. You can't run. like you want to, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So when you take the guitar off my neck, then I'm like that horse. I can get out the gate, I can stretch my legs, and I can,
right.
you know, I can run the race. But the guitar is a hinder if for us, because I love to dance.
Yeah.
And I'll be done.
Yeah, you can't be dancing with a guitar strapped around your neck.
I'll be done, jump too far and the plug come out. I've tried all that shit.
So who's playing all the slide guitar on the record? Is that Russ Paul?
Yeah, I think so.
He's great.
I think him and Dan played slide.
Okay.
When we was in there, I don't know which one.
Yeah, you can hear two of them sort of feeding off each other.
I don't know which one hit which note, but
yeah,
like say it's so much stuff that goes on that those guys see they be still working when I go. Once I lay my track down and get the lyrics right, they get it enough to for me to know where I need to go. Then I'm pretty much gone if I'm not playing. Or not needed at the studio. There's so much more I need to, be doing.
Yeah, man.
See, like we're right here. We could have did this interview pretty much anywhere in the world,
That's right.
Thanks to technology. So
most of the songs are written by you on the record, but I know there's one song, "All My Hope," that's a traditional song. Is that one that goes back a long time for you? Like, is that a song that you grew up singing or
what's No. That song, like I said, we was on tour and Dan, Bobby Woods was playing that song.
Okay.
On his phone. He was playing that song on his phone and I heard it and I liked it. So I asked him, who was that? And then I don't know if the guy was singing it was the one that wrote it or what, but it was a black guy and white guy was doing a duet with it, and the white guy was doing the piano. And I asked Bobby to play it again for me, and he played it again. And I said, well, man, I like that song. I wouldn't mind doing that. And I said, I'd like to do that. And he said, well, I'll talk to Dan and see what he say. And we on tour, and we was at rehearsal. And we got through rehearsal, and I didn't even think nothing else about it. And then that's when Dan said for me and Bobby to do it as a duet, just like the other people did it. So Bobby played it, and I started, to hit the notes. And then I had the note right. But I didn't know the words.
Yeah.
So that Dan suggested that I put it on my phone and put my earplugs in and just go.
Oh, okay.
Go sit out in the lobby or get away from the band and just listen to it. So I did. I listened to the song over and over and over until and sung along with it while the band was over there practicing. Mm-hmm. And when I came back in the studio, Dan said, "You think you got it?" I said, "I'll try it." and we did it, and everybody loved it. And so we started doing it on the tour. And everywhere we went, we did it. And
people loved it.
Just loved it. I would be done song and dance and played the guitar and everything else. But then when we got ready to do that song, I'd always get on the stool and sit down.
Oh, nice.
You know, to get serious, I guess you would say. But I'd always sit down on the stool and just sing it like
that's a beautiful
like
thing.
I wrote it. And and then after we did it on a couple of stops, mm-hmm. then the rest of the band decided they wanted to get in on it in background. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the band started, you know, they all sung anyway. They all sung back up on Dan's albums. And they were singing back up on that tour.
Beautiful.
So they all joined in. And then that allowed me, when they started to doing the background, that allowed me to have more leeway to do more ad-lib.
Right. Which is what you're most comfortable with anyway.
Right. So I gave me a chance to loosen up and do my thing.
This year's been so crazy, obviously, and with the new record out, have you started booking shows and tours and stuff like that, or are you waiting to kind of see what happens?
Well, I got booking agents that they haven't given me the list for the year, but I think I would be comfortable doing festivals and
outdoor stuff.
Venues. As a matter of fact, I did a couple, you know, solo gigs, you know, a little birthday bashes and stuff lately. And people are, you know, been well response, you know, had good turnouts. I try not to draw too big of a crowd.
Right. Are you going to stay away from like clubs and theaters and stuff for a while, or will you do those if they come up?
I really don't know. It just depends on what you know, on the environment. And I did my part. I've taken both for the vaccination. But I don't know what the other people done. So the thing is, you know, people like to show your love by embracing and
right.
And people like to take a lot of, you know, photos. People believe in that. It all depends. I'll have to be led by the spirit to what I'm gonna do and when I'm gonna do it.
I hear you.
Like that song say, "All my hope is in Jesus." That's the time to put it to a test. So I'm like, I don't believe. I don't believe in going anywhere that I can't speak openly about my faith and my Christianity walk, you know.
Good.
So I'll be depending on. If he'll have to make those decisions, because you got to look at if I just do it my way and not consider, then I'm endangering all my family, all my friends, all my fans.
There's a lot to consider these days.
There's a lot to consider. Now, you know what I'm saying? I don't mind wearing masks and stuff, but it's hard to sing with a mask on.
It sure is. Yeah.
It's hard. If you're sitting in a club, it's hard to take a drink with a mask on.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? There's a lot of negative stuff come from the mask.
Yeah.
But then with everything comes a little humor.
Sure.
You don't know if the girl sitting beside you is ugly or not. With the mask on. So hell.
Everyone's beautiful.
Everybody beautiful with the mask on. So, you know, it's some good
That's so true, man. I'm a musician too, and I've been playing with people during the pandemic in studios recently with masks on, and it's the first time I've ever met them, and it's weird that I don't even know what they look like. And then I see them without their mask on, and it's like, hey, that's weird. I didn't even realize you looked like that. There's a lot of that going on.
Well, see what we did. Everybody, before we went in the studio for the videos, everybody was tested.
Yep.
And got the results before we went into the studio.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we wasn't huddling up. I'm in a booth. Everybody mm-hmm. else properly social distance, you know, practice everything to be as safe as possible.
Yeah, yeah. There's ways to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of adapting that's going to have to happen now, too, with shows and recording. But it seems like people are getting the hang of it slowly. Well, hey, Robert, thanks so much, man, for talking to me today. And, you know, I hope you got lots more records in you. I love the new album. And
I tell you, man, even this stuff here with the pandemic and stuff going on, with so much happening and the way people having to change and communicate and stuff.
Yeah.
See, that brings about just day-to-day experience brings about songs because people want to hear about things they can relate to.
That's right.
And since everybody's going through this stuff, it wouldn't be hard to be creative on songs. All you got to do is tell the truth.
You do it really well, man, and I appreciate you. And so glad made the new record, and hope to see you in Nashville one of these days.
I'll look forward to that.
All right, man. Okay.
All right.
Folks, that was my conversation with Robert Finley. Hope you enjoyed listening. I had a blast talking to him. We'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. Over and out. See you then. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.